Well, I appreciate about being here. I wanted to encourage everybody to come hear Steve Austin tonight. We walked around with a lot of different people, a lot of PhDs, Del and I did, around the United States. And really, this documentary wouldn't have happened without Steve Austin. When I was basically looking for the geologist to interview, everyone said, well, you got to go interview Steve Austin. And I called Steve, and he said, well, I don't do interviews in any place that's not the field, and particularly my favorite place is Mount St. Helens. And so if I'm going to do an interview with you, we got to go to Mount St. Helens. But one of the things about it, Dr. Austin, he took us down to the bottom of this canyon. I would really, my eyes, when you're walking around a canyon, when you're walking around Grand Canyon with a geologist, you just start to see things you'd never seen before. So I would encourage you to come out. You may think, well, is that going to be interesting to me? I can promise you, you will be fascinated. If you've never even thought about geology since seventh grade physical science class, it will open your eyes again to it. So please come out tonight to hear Dr. Austin. It'll be a great time. Okay, so I have to have a moment. I teach a Bible study every Wednesday night to 20 junior and senior high students, and this makes me mildly nervous. So if I ever pause for a minute, it's because I'm collecting my thoughts and I can't believe I'm in front of this many people. I made films so that I would not have to be in front of this many people to communicate. So let me see here. Timing. I've got a few slides I put together. I asked my wife what I should talk about, and she always advises me well. She was a Covenant College grad. We've been in the PCA a long time. She predates me in the PCA by quite a bit. Went to school with Ike Reeder, and they were missionaries to Vienna for a number of years. So Dr. Reeder, she holds very near and dear in her heart. He played a very key role when she was just coming out of college. And so we love the Reeders, and it's a privilege to be here at Briarwood. She was not able to be here, sadly. But she told me, I need to talk about what does Genesis matter today? And so I put some slides together, usually at the last minute. And I wanted to bring up three verses that I think are very interesting. So this is what Jesus is saying. And he says, for as were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. So this is interesting. When Jesus wants to put his second coming in context, he goes back to something that happened, you know, thousands and thousands of years before. And it's clear that Jesus thought that Noah was historical. He's going to be talking about the future, which is going to be happening. And so he's taking the past and the present and the future, and he's putting them all in context of this one guy that lived a long time ago. So clearly, our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ thought Noah was a pretty important person and categorized his life in respect of Noah's life. That's what he's talking about. So this is an interesting painting that a Russian guy did. It's the best I found of what was the flood potentially like. In this picture, if you see the guy kind of shaking his fist, this is the people who were left. And so you're looking at, this is what his coming will be like, this picture of judgment that's all wrapped up in this. If there wasn't a global flood, well, then it begins to be very questionable. What does that mean about a global judgment that will come in the future? So something to think about. Jesus, again, the Pharisees come to him. We all know this passage. It's usually talked about when you hear a sermon on divorce. But the Pharisees came to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? And he answered, have you not read? Now, I always like it that he's pointing to the text. He says, okay, so you've read this, right? So he knows that there is a book of Genesis that he's assuming all these Pharisees have read. And he will often, I just always like to listen to the way Jesus is talking to people. It's fascinating. He says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? And said, therefore, a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. I mean, you could probably do six sermons on just this one passage. There's so much there. But again, it's obvious that this idea of there being a man and a woman, and we'll put some, we'll go to our friend Lucas Kranach, see if we can go up there. Oh. I asked if I could put this up, and I think it's far enough away we can do it. Lucas Kranach, he was Martin Luther's, it's kind of, you know, Del and I just got back from in Europe, and they just have different views of these things in Europe. But Lucas Kranach was Luther's painter, And so this is this picture, and they would put different scenes up here. But the middle one is this idea of God telling Adam and Eve what to do. And you have a picture that Jesus is recognizing there was a real man and woman that were the first men and women that were created. It's written about in Genesis. He's expecting everybody to know it. So that's always the assumption. And because of this, there are certain things we can know today about marriage, about divorce, about sex. I mean, it's all there. That's what that passage is talking about. So clearly, Genesis is very foundational for that. One more here. So let's go back to Genesis. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This is the famous proto-evangelium. God is cursing the serpent here, but he's really talking forward about what's going to happen. And again, what is this? He's talking about the crucifixion, obviously. This is Rembrandt. He's talking about a point in time. So again, now we're going back to Genesis that's looking forward to a different point in history. And I think what it shows you is that history is kind of, it's all sewn together and all the pieces fit. And it's hard to take out one piece without unraveling other pieces. And I think that's kind of my point I want to make here this morning, is that theology is embedded in history. Now, I get this idea from Gerhardus Voss. He was a Dutch theologian that taught at Princeton for many years. And Voss wrote a lot on biblical theology, but he says over and over again that if you look at history, really you have to find that theology is within it, that everything's embedded. The crucifixion is a point in time, and our redemption is embedded in it. This is why the liberals wanted to take out the idea of the death and resurrection of Jesus, or at least they have to have his death, but no resurrection. It's why the miracles have to go. It's why all these things have got to go. It's why anything in the Old Testament that's miraculous has to go. That's where the theology is actually embedded in it. And so if you can take that out of the history, well, the theology goes. And a lot of Christians don't always realize this, that we are essentially a historically based religion. Everything we believe, I mean, we believe that this guy is sweating, tired, you know, laughing, eating guy died a number of years ago. And all of universal history kind of rests on that. And then if you follow Luke, in Luke chapter 3, that sweating, breathing guy, if you start following his father and grandfather and so forth, going back down through the line, you eventually get to another sweating, breathing guy that lived at one point and died. In this case, Adam. So I say all this at a point that history is this very interesting blanket or quilt that everything's embedded in. And so my point that I also want to make is if history changes, then your theology changes. And if that's a really big deal, this idea of that's really one of the reasons I wanted to make this film, was that I wanted to show that there's actually a reasonable basis for believing this. But more importantly, we as Christians, about 200 years ago, the attack was made. I like to say the Enlightenment made three attacks on the church, which we're still dealing with. One of them was, is Genesis really true? The second one is, is basically the Bible really true? The higher and lower criticism went after. And the third being, is Jesus really God? I mean, these are the three big things. And so Genesis, I wanted to deal with it with a film. And so what I want to do this morning, though, I know Dr. Tackett preached this morning, and you're going to hear Dr. Austin tonight. And these are kind of the heavyweights. I'm kind of the lightweight. But I just want to bring up a few 6 points to think about and ways that Genesis matters today. So let me see. We'll talk about the Bible, talk about the original earth, the nature of man, death, marriage and sex, and this idea of God's providence. Now, there's a lot more we could bring up, but these are just 6 I grabbed. I created a Bible study that I've actually got if you come tonight, I got a bunch of extra copies of the book that they didn't print them right, so I thought I'd give them away free. But they go through 6 doctrines, and I think that's important, is how do these 6 key doctrines, this isn't all of that, but it shows how Christianity and Genesis are very hinged together, these 6 key doctrines, and these are kind of sort of based on it. What I would bring up first, and this is what I talk about in the film with these two, I mentioned these two paradigms. If you haven't seen the film, that's fine. I'll try to explain it. As I began to read things, I began to realize that if you just look at history as history, well, then it's based on things like time and duration and events. I mean, we all know this. We think about World War II. If you say, you know, World War II, well, if you're a European, World War II started in 1939. If you're American, it's 41. But, and then it ended in, you know, 1945. We have dates of it. If someone comes and tells you, you know, World War II actually lasted, you know, 45 years, you're like, okay, well, how do you get to that? That you change the time, you have to suddenly find new events that go into it. You know, someone might be able to argue it lasted over 20 years if you want to start at World War I and go to World War II, and they can make that argument. But that's, again, time and duration. You got to change your events. So when I began to look at this, I began to realize there really are only two views of time out there. Granted, there are Christians that will hold to an old earth view, and I know that they hold to this, but my view is that they're just taking a time structure that's been already established. I'm not saying whether it's true or not. I just want to simply say there's only two views of time. And I say this, see if we can do this. So this is Sinai, and I guess it's a Tissot painting. The reason I bring this up is that at Sinai is where you actually see the first establishment of time and the purpose. Why did God create the world in 6 days? And so he says, basically, I mean, you all read it there, is he basically made the 6 days because of the Sabbath. And this idea of rest and these ideas of 6 days of work is a real structure. And, I mean, God could have done it any number of ways, but we realize he did it to give us a pattern. 6 normal days. There's a lot of good reasons you can look at 6 days. From an engineering perspective, as Stuart Burgess said, if you want everything working, you got to have it all there together and put it together. And that's a fascinating perspective of, we have a radically complex world, and so 6 days where everything is happening very quickly actually makes the more sense. I mean, we make an engineer something. You don't make a little bit of this here and a few days later put this together and put that. You basically take the car and you put all the pieces are designed and you put it all together and it works. And this could be looked at in many ways of machining, but not to get off on that topic. I apologize. I end up with a lot of rabbit trails in this world, and so I could kind of, I like to set up, doing this was like going down Alice's, you know, the rabbit hole, and you just kind of keep going, and so I apologize. Sometimes the brain wanders off. The second view of history says that, well, you know, the universe, it took a long time to form. And so this is kind of a snapshot of 13.7 billion years. And, I mean, you've got there the Big Bang and inflation and these slow galaxies. There at the last bit, on the far right, that's the galactic cooling event that would have, you know, formed our solar system, you know, around 4.5 billion years ago or so. And the view of it is quite interesting. It means that the Earth didn't exist for about 9 billion years. There is no, so the heavens and the Earth, well, there was no Earth, if you follow this view. And as you keep going into it, you know, this would then be the general view of the history of the Earth, of life on it, and you've got, you know, it kind of gets hard, maybe hard to read, you know, well, there's about 1 billion years, then you have single cells show up, and then they kind of move along, and then about 500 million years ago, this is not done in terms of time. See, that's the other issue. It's really hard to do time because it's so big. And so when you start thinking about it, I mean, the best story was from Mark Twain. And he said, you know, they're telling us that all of Earth history is like the size of all of the history of the universe is the size of the Eiffel Tower. And that little skin of paint on the top, that's human history. And they say it's all that little skin of paint at the top of the Eiffel Tower, that's the most important point. And he says, well, I guess it is, if that's what they say. And so it kind of puts it in perspective that the majority of, we've not been around, if you follow this view of history, for, I mean, 99.9999% of things. And most of your non-Christians that talk about it will say it. They'll talk about how it's, you know, if the history of the universe is your arm, a little bitty edge of your fingernail is all of, or, you know, the history of mankind. It's just, it's insanely small. That is in composed to this idea of what you see in about the Bible, is it says, well, the Lord made the heavens and the earth. He is God. He formed the earth and made it. He established it. He did not create it empty. He formed it to be inhabited. He said, I am the Lord and there is no other. I did not speak in secret in a land of darkness. I did not say to the offspring of Jacob, seek me in vain. I, the Lord, speak the truth. I declare what is right. Now, these two views of history of things taking a really, really, really long time, and there's no man and there's no people and there's no even any earth, And then the earth, if it did exist, it would have been through, you know, the Hadean period and the Archean and billions of years of just lifelessness. And then this view that, well, God created the earth in 6 days, 6 normal days, and it was perfectly ready for people to live in, and then it was engineered for people to live in. These, I would suggest, are radically different histories. And even a Christian that has to hold to an old earth view has got to then begin to reconcile all of these verses in the Bible. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because, I mean, you just go look at Isaiah 40 through 46. He's constantly talking about, well, the reason you can trust me is because, well, I made the heavens and the earth. You can see that. So this is why you know that I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And I bring this up to say that if you start looking at the Bible, so I'm in the PCA and I go to George Grant's church in Franklin, Tennessee. And so we interviewed George at the end of this. I realized he was the best guy to interview. And he points out the Bible talks about Genesis over and over. All these authors, Paul and the author in Hebrews and, you know, Revelation, it's all there. All the Gospels writers are bringing it up. Jesus is bringing it up. It's just assumed, just as Jesus said, haven't you read the book? Everyone knows what it's talking about. So the point is that when you start dealing and changing the history, you start having to reinterpret a lot of verses in the Bible in ways that clearly have never been done before. And even the guys writing the Bible obviously didn't think this just from the context of what they're saying. So that said, let's go see what Paul said. Another famous verse. We could go into a lot of them. But what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. So here's what's interesting. Perceived by whom? This is, I think it was Doug Wilson who made the comment and said that, you know, it's not as if there was an empty auditorium for billions of years that God was performing up there. It may be like me being here, but everyone and me talking and not no one being here, which would probably be understandable. But I say all this to say that if you kind of imagine that, that's this picture, is that God essentially has created this world where his attributes have been embedded into the creation and no one's there to pay attention. As opposed to this picture that, well, he created the world and put us in it so that we would be able to see everything and then reflect on our relationship with him, that we were created in his image and so on and so forth. And that's what Paul's saying. And then he takes this and then draws it all the way into the way people are acting today. I mean, this is the genius of Paul. I mean, he's about to go here, and let's just go where Paul goes. He's about to go into idolatry and the movement to homosexuality. So that's what's quite interesting here, is that idolatry, sexuality, our relationship to God, these are all related things. I mean, we'll come back to this, but I mean, that's what Paul understood it, that Genesis kind of forms this nexus of which everything else radiates out of. And if you don't get it, well, everything else is going to get screwed up. Okay, where are we? Genesis and the earth. I usually ask for questions, and I was told you can't do questions, so I'm not doing questions, but I keep feeling like, well, you have questions about this, so I apologize if I'm running too fast. These are two pictures that most people don't think about or know about, because people don't always talk about what the history of the earth is if you're following the conventional view of the world. So that one to the left is a picture of planetesimals. So if you follow the conventional view of earth creation, is that there was a galactic cooling event and these gases slowly began to coalesce and they formed little bitty dust particles, and those dust particles hit and formed rocks, and slowly everything around formed out of this. Now, I mean, it's got to come from somewhere. As one physicist, actually an astrophysicist, pointed out, the challenge comes not when dust is hitting each other, but when things get to be about a meter wide and start smacking into each other, they have a tendency physically not to get bigger, but smaller. But that's neither here nor there, the physics of it. The point is that this view of planetesimals means that the Earth was forming over hundreds of thousands of years. Let's just give them and say it was possible. Then it meant that there was, this is the next picture, is the Hadean Earth. And that was a billion years. It's questionable how long, but it's this molten period of just no one's going to live for sure. But it was like Hades. That's why it's called the Hadean. Like, it's hellish. And so that would have been the first billion years. And so the point is, this is a totally different view of Earth history, that it didn't even exist. And then, you know, basically it was a hell on Earth. I was talking to a guy at Wheaton. He is a geologist. Who's a theistic evolutionist. And we showed our film up at Wheaton, and it was a little controversial. The kids actually invited us up there, but the professors were very unhappy. And they put up a stink, and as one of the professors said, there's 200 professors at Wheaton, and only three he thinks are creationists, or like young earth creationists. Theistic evolution, you know, John Walton's up there, the theistic evolutionists are very strong. And I asked this guy, I said, so do you believe in, he's a Christian. I mean, he is a Christian. I just think he's adopted wrong views of our history. I said, so do you believe in planetesimals? The formation of the earth by planetesimals? Did God do this? And I saw him kind of look at me kind of like, okay, I've got to own this because that's what I believe. And he said, yes, I do. I was like, well, okay, so you're saying 100,000 years, God's slowly putting little particles together. Is that right? Yes, that's right. And so I think it's important if you're going to hold a young earth creation, yes, we have to own some challenging questions. There's a lot of questions, I think, that aren't out there. But if you hold to an old earth, there's some crazy things, in my opinion, you've got to hold to as a Christian. So if you're going to own it, make people eat it. I mean, if I'm going to have to deal with, okay, that the earth is only 7,000-8,000 years old, well, there's a ton of things I got to deal with. Well, if you're going to deal with the earth is billions of years and you're a Christian, you got a ton of things you got to deal with. People have to own that. So anyway, that said, this, on the other hand, is what I would say is the earth is created as. And you'll hear people all the time. I think it was Ligon Duncan and Tim Keller have some discussion about this. And, you know, I think Tim Keller's an old earth guy. And Tim's sitting there talking about how beautiful and wonderful the earth was originally. And, of course, Ligon is saying this is part of our doctrine. You know, the Westminster Confession of Faith says, you know, that God created this. And I know Ligon is a young earth creationist. And I'm thinking, well, if you believe in old earth, this is not the picture. This doesn't happen until much older. Unless you're a creationist and a young earth creationist, well, this happened immediately. In fact, it probably was much more wonderful than this. I mean, this has got mountains, so this is obviously, we can't get a picture of what it was like before the flood. But I say all this to say that we have a view that the earth was created perfect and good and it has gotten worse. Not a view that the earth was worse and has gotten better. So these are radically, again, different views of history. Let's talk about the nature of man. So this is kind of an interesting, this is from the Lascaux Caves, some of the earliest art that's been found, and that's cuneiform. So one of the observations that a guy named Michael Pogliani, he's a Christian philosopher of science, and he's a scientist, observes that what makes man very interesting is not that he has tools, but that he makes machines, and that he creates things in places that are basically for others to know and see. Does that make sense? So he's doing something because he is self-aware and he knows others are self-aware. So let's think about this. This painting was painted by an amazing artist, very likely someone after the flood. They had ended up in caves and basically because, as Dr. Austin has often pointed out, it was a horrible period after the flood. It wasn't as if the flood ended and it kind of went away. It was like things were awful for a long period, you know, as he talks about, this idea of the exponential decline. You know, things were really bad and they slowly got better and better. Well, the point is this, whoever was the painter of this wanted someone else to come see it. You don't usually paint just for yourself. So you're thinking about others and you're thinking about time. In the same way, this is a cuneiform tablet, very early writing. You're wanting someone else to read this. And so what's interesting about the nature of man is our unique self-awareness. And as being in the image of God, we can make tools that then can be made into machines. I mean, let's be honest. There is not anybody, an orangutan, that's made one of these. And I say this to say that we will have machines on machines on machines just so we can live and do what we don't. And that's an aspect of the image of God. What you do is you see this wherever there's people. And it's actually called the sapient paradox. It's written about, Colin Renfrew talks about it, and it's a problem in any view of long progressive view, is why, if people evolved, did they not look like people earlier? Makes sense? Like, why do we not have this sudden appearance of technology, the sudden appearance of writing, these sudden appearances of things? It's a real problem. And so what I would suggest is that where you see people, you see this, and if you don't see this, it's probably right after the flood, because things were really horrible and people were just trying to survive. But as soon as the world slowed down, all of a sudden, guess what? You begin to see all this. So it's kind of curious, the nature of man being made in the image of God, again, says we start that way and it got worse, but that, you know, basically through redemption and civilization, things will get better. The other way is that, it's this long, long progression. So again, the third thing, let's talk about death. So when I was back at Wheaton, I had been invited by the Creation Society there. And it was a bunch of really freshmen and sophomores, very sharp young men and women. And I sat around the table with them. They wanted me to take me to dinner, of course, before we showed the film. And there were four of them there, and I asked them, I said, well, actually, this was the second time I came back, so sorry, I'm messing my mind. The first time I went, it was really interesting to hear these picture of liberalism that had kind of moved into Wheaton, and kind of how theistic evolution was really moving into the evangelical church. And they said that many of their parents were not aware of this. How many Christian colleges have adopted theistic evolution? And it's a real issue. It's an issue, I mean, I know John Walton's book for years ago was being taught at Covenant College. Because I know a kid that was using it. I talked to Derek recently. He said that's not the case now. But my point is that most colleges that are Christian are teaching some form of theistic evolution because that's what they're pushing. And so I talked to these kids and I said, so why are you an Earth creationist? And all four of them said exactly the same answer. They're very articulate. And they said, you know, if you look at this evolutionary view of the world, what it says is that death was always a part of the world. And that if death is always a part of the world, then it means that God created things to die. And this is something Dr. Tackett has pushed on over and over again, is that death is either a result of the fall, or it basically is something that has predated the fall for billions of years and is an essential part of the universe. And the result is it really is a pretty bad reflection on God if this is the way he created the universe. And I, you know, a lot of non-Christians will actually kind of bring these up like, well, here, non-Christians don't much care for theistic evolutionists either because they're kind of this halfway house. They're like, look, just go all the way. Why would a God? I mean, you go read Darwin's work. He's arguing with Asa Gray in a series of letters. Asa Gray was actually a liberal Presbyterian that taught at Harvard as a botanist. And Asa Gray wanted to say, look, evolution can work with Christianity. And Darwin was like, I don't think so. And he basically discusses this, these little points about nature, saying, I can't imagine a good God doing this. So, meaning pain, death, suffering. And I think that's a really important point we have to realize is that if God created a world that was perfect and good and did not have death, and trust me, there's tons of weird things to question, like, well, what does that mean for fish and what does that mean for plants and the important questions that are worth discussing. But if you just look at it from a textual perspective and what we believe and know, I mean, how many of us have had a dog that's died and you're like, this is horrible, and people mourn and cry over it. I mean, you see an animal that's died and it just seems wrong. I would suggest it's because it is wrong. It wasn't part of the original creation. But if you have a view that the fall, and this is Thomas Cole's picture of the fall, so you kind of see the fall on the left, and you know it's the beautiful, the garden still on the right. If you have this view that everything's always been like it was on the left, then it gets very hard to wonder how it was ever on the right like that. If that makes any sense. So even if an old Earth creationist holds to this, you've got to have death for millions and billions of years because they've accepted a timeline that essentially changes their theology. And many of them don't realize that they bump up against each other because most people don't really realize the power of history. History, I would say, is far more powerful. What happened in the past is a very big deal. It influences the present. Okay, let's talk about this, a very important one. Get back to Jesus' comment, Genesis, marriage, and sex. We all know what the issues of our day are going on. We see it around us everywhere. I mean, it's the sexual revolution has come full circle from the 60s all the way, you know, to the teens. And it's crazy what we see going on. Well, the only way that there's a full stop on this is you got to go back to Genesis. And if God created a male and female originally, intentionally, purposefully, and he made them to be married, then that's all there is. And everything else is some aberration. Everything else is some result of sin. And it's just as I may struggle with issues of pride, or I may struggle with issues of lust. These are all things that are wrong and that are part of my sin nature. But the point is that I can at least say I know that sin because of what I know is good. And this is true and right. I mean, we're facing this in the PCA with a lot of these issues. But the simple solution is you go back to Genesis. And if you hold that Genesis is really a book that is just a good book of history, then it changes how we view sexuality. At least it gives us the parameters in the way God created it. And many of the things that we see today, it's very easy to kind of say, well, that's a counterfeit, because we know what the real thing is. And so I would just encourage you to say that I think Genesis probably has more to say about the sexual issues going on today than any other book does, really. And in many cases, Paul picks this up in Romans 1. You can make that clear study, how he moves from idolatry and he's linking Genesis and the creation. Okay. Genesis and God's providence. I'm making good time here. I was trying to get everyone out early. I mean, I can be an over-talker and just keep going and going on this. So I'm trying to pace myself. Genesis and God's providence is a very interesting question. So if we as Presbyterians believe, and, you know, Calvinists, that God has ordered and controlled all events of time, well, that means he's ordered all events of time. And what it means is, I'm filling up this conventional view. What it says is that for 13.7 billion years, he's basically created a universe that doesn't really seem to reflect him and is not really a reflection of what he's told us about. And so what it would suggest, though, is that all these events that have ever happened have to be laid at his feet from a providential perspective, that he wanted this to happen. He wanted this thing to kind of be without people for basically almost all of its existence. He wanted there to be death and lifelessness for almost all of its existence. And so what I would suggest is that this view of Earth history is essentially one that will lead to some form of atheism, because as Christians, as made in God's image, we can't stand the idea of thinking of a God that would be this just dark and impersonal. I mean, this is the movement toward deism. And even deism doesn't really hold water for very long. It's quite easy to get rid of it. And so you see this thinking in the Enlightenment period. And this, I would say, again, is something you have to own. And that atheism, this is a history that fits atheism very, very well, because it's an empty history. And I would suggest that the history that we have in the Bible is a radically different history. And it's the history that fits Christianity. Doug Kelly had made this observation to me. Dr. Kelly he's interviewed in our second materials. He was very influential with this film. You may know him. He's one of the old grandfathers of the PCA and taught at Reformed Theological Seminary for years. He wrote a fantastic book called Creation and Change, probably one of the most influential books on this, about examining what is the historical and exegetical history of Genesis. And he made the observation to me that really, the evolutionary view of the world existed in the pagan society, but was pushed out by the early church, and you don't see it reemerging until the Enlightenment. So that's, you know, 1500, almost 2000 years, well, 1800 years. Well, what's interesting, I was recently reading Athanasius's On the Incarnation. That was for some other project I was working on. And his first chapters, and Athanasius was a presbyter in Alexandria, and was obviously fighting on the Trinitarian issues. And Athanasius wrote this important book, you know, so, okay, we're going to talk about the incarnation. But he starts with creation. His first two chapters are about creation. And he immediately starts talking about the evolutionists that are the Epicureans. And he says, look, they believe that everything was material and progressed over long periods of time. And he kind of explains it there. But this is totally opposite of what we as Christians believe, because basically, you know, this is essentially a pagan view. And I think that's important to realize. And of course, then he goes on about two chapters later and says, so why did I start with creation? Well, creation is directly linked to the incarnation of Jesus. And he makes this connection. The point is that what we're dealing with today is absolutely not new. It is absolutely not unusual. It just happens to be wrapped up with a little more technological flash to try to get people to accept it. And I would suggest, though, that as Christians, we have to realize that this, as a dominant worldview, is very powerful. I mean, it's powerful for kids. I don't remember if y'all may not have been there last night, if you weren't. The reason I made this film is I made it after a conversation I had with my 10-year-old daughter. She's now 16. But she had seen this, you know, Bill Nye and Ken Ham debate, and basically she was quite young and had never really thought about evolutionary. I mean, we not taught her evolutionary theory. I mean, she's 10. We explained the Bible. But so she heard it explained this pretty well. And she said, you know, this is a different story than what's taught in the Bible. And she kind of keyed into this very, very quickly, that I think every student, and maybe when you, I remember when I was going through biology class, I went to a Roman Catholic high school, so they taught, you know, theistic evolution. And I remember running across this and thinking, well, this is just a totally different view of the world. And it kind of rocked my world a little bit. And so I began to get books to read on both sides of the story. And at the time, my aunt had rejected Christianity, was a cultural anthropologist, PhD. And so she saw me reading some of these books. She'd kind of ignored the evolutionist versions and saw some of the creationists and went just crazy and so angry and began to ask me a series of questions. Basically, the liberal college professor asking the 16-year-old kid every hard question in the book. You know, how do you know that animals are the same molecular as we are? How do you know they have a soul? What does it mean we're made in the image of God? How do you, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it kind of launched me on this quest, but that was in thinking that, you know, I think the Bible is a good book of history. But that had been 30 years before, so when my daughter started asking me these questions, I realized, oh, this is still relevant. It hasn't changed. It's exactly the same issue. And so that was really what led me into trying to, is there a documentary that can be made? In a sense, it's aimed, I mean, if you could say it, it's aimed kind of for high school kids. Problem is, I know it's complex, and these topics are not simple, and so it's, if you watch the film, it's like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, I get that. But it's because it's the Minority Report and no one was going to believe and say, well, you know, says you. Well, you got to put a lot of evidence out there. But I say all this to say that I think that ultimately we have to defend God and his providence and his actions in time for our children, for us, for just the world around us. And in a sense, we're the ones who are supposed to say, no, God has done good things in the past. But it's man who is screwed up. It's man who sinned. He's therefore cursed the world and cursed his creation. And in the future, he's going to redeem it. And so I think the whole view of history and time and our salvation and our gospel relates and hinges on this issue of providence. And then, of course, the biblical view of providence, and this is this, if you can see it, it looks like probably ants on a hill. It's actually supposed to be the Exodus with them following you know, the God out of Egypt. And you realize that God is ordering things toward his own glory in ways that may be kind of even hard to follow. Like those guys that were following along, I'm sure they did not know where things were headed. And so there's a sense here we have to kind of just trust, you know, I think that that is true. And I don't understand every aspect of it, but it actually, there probably is a good reason somewhere, whether I can understand it or not. I think that's a helpful thing. It's not always about the answers, because as I was laughing with Danny Faulkner. He said if it was his view, it would be called Questions in Genesis. Because there's always questions that have to be asked. I've gotten to the end of this, well, I'm not the end, but I've gotten 4 or 5 years into this and read tons and realized I've got tons of questions of things I don't understand and know. And I think that's much more a reflection of the way the world is that this is not about having the right answers. It's about saying, oh, the Bible's true and there are things that we can know, but science helps us to understand something of the world around us. But our knowledge, our epistemology, really comes from believing the Bible is an accurate book of history and things that have happened in the past. I'm going to end with this. One of the best verses in the Bible about the heavens and the earth really comes from Nehemiah. And it's this great statement. He says, "You are the Lord, you alone. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens, with all their hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve all of them. And the host of heaven worships you." So the angels worshiping God, and this idea of preservation, that the world we see today, this good world that exists that we don't even think about. I mean, if you think about just for a moment that each of you has over 3 billion small letters of DNA and you have probably 75 billion cells in your body. I may get that wrong. It may be trillion. And most of them have DNA, and they're constantly changing to keep you alive. And it's unique in each one of you. And you start to think about that in every living thing. That's also the case. That all, I mean, the chairs you're sitting on, the atoms, the way they're holding together, the fact that that cloth is far more comfortable than, say, steel, that there are different types of materials, that they work in a certain way, that there's atmospheres that we can breathe. So I don't know if you saw the movie The Martian. It's an interesting film. But it came out recently, and what it showed you was the impossibility of, it has Matt Damon in it, so he's this guy, just to tell you the story, he's a NASA astronaut, He's on Mars. There's six of them. And he gets marooned on Mars. They all have to leave. There's a big storm coming. And I think he's dead and he's marooned. And he has to figure out how to live on Mars. And so what's very interesting is he has to figure out ways to take and recreate the Earth on another planet, because Mars is not livable. And you start looking at Venus, you look at Jupiter, none of these planets are livable. And what we have here is very unique, and so it's a fascinating picture. He gets a small calculation wrong when he's trying to create water between hydrogen and oxygen, and it creates an explosion that literally throws him through a wall, meaning we don't even realize the tiny, tiny, tiny precision, that way that God has created this world to preserve. We just kind of live in it. And that's why I would say is kind of the awe of our existence in many ways is that we don't even think. We eat food, we go about our daily business, and yet God has basically done all this for us. And so I think that the idea of ultimately ending in worship, which is where he's a professor, Truett McConnell, but one of the scientists, Kurt Wise, would often say that creation and studying creation leads you to devotion. And I think that that's right. When you really start to see it, there's kind of that awe of, okay, this is pretty amazing what God has done. And in light of that, I think that that's what one of the encouraging things. It's a privilege to be here to have a church go through this. I told Dr. Reeder there are very few folks in the PCA that would even talk about this. And I think it's the vital thing to be talking about. This is actually one of the biggest issues. And so I appreciate y'all doing this. And I know that you've been blessed with Dr. Tackett, and we'll get blessed again tonight with Steve Austin. You've got some great guys. Two of the best guys on the project are right here with you. And so I think that you have a great opportunity to really learn a lot from them. So thanks for the opportunity to be here, and we appreciate it.